truth seekers. It is 7 past the hour. The madness continues. The madness continues. According to the Arizona Republic, a female Republican representative in that state, Terry Proud of Tucson, now wants to have a law in that state where any woman wanting an abortion must watch one being performed before having one herself. Republican Terry Proud of Tucson made that comment on March 5th in an email, said she'd personally like to make a law requiring that women watch a surgical abortion before undergoing the procedure. She said it would provide transparency and added that that shouldn't be a problem if women aren't harmed by having abortions. Gone far enough for you yet? Had enough yet? Gone far enough for you yet? Oh, my God. Boy, how about before you can have, I don't know, I can't think of any comparable madness. Can anyone? You have to watch an appendectomy before you? No, that's too. For men who are having problems with erections, should they watch a prostatectomy? Is that how you say it?
I think they should watch a vasectomy.
Watch a vasectomy before I see. Well, that's. I mean, this. How much further are the Republicans going to take this issue? This hour is being sponsored by Clark Morgan. And his message is, liberal talk radio is the best antidote for hate radio. Thanks, Mike and Kathy. Well, thanks, Clark. Thank you very much. Regarding the murder of Trayvon Martin near Sanford, Florida, and George Zimmerman's involvement as the trigger man, Fred in Howe's Neck, Mass, writes, Mike, in the very first of the released 9/11 takes, Mr. Zimmerman prefaced his so-called report with a remark to the effect that, quote, there have been a lot of break-ins recently, end quote, in that neighborhood. To the best of my knowledge, nobody has checked and reported on whether or not that statement is true. Surely the cops would be knowledgeable and instantly on the alert if this indeed were true. However, it seems to me that rarely, if ever, have law enforcement been confronted with the situation in which a gated community's security was so cavalierly breached. What am I missing here? Fred and his last name in Howe's Neck, Mass. Tonight's program, we have like a double treat for you. We have a moment with Bob. We also have Uncle Mike's Story Corner. And I think you're probably just going to thoroughly enjoy Uncle Mike's Story Corner tonight. And of course, we always enjoy our moments with Bob, don't we? A couple emails here. Well, here's one. This is from Rick in San Leandro, California. Kathy brought up the question a couple of nights ago, about a week or so ago. And Rick is going to try to answer this question. To answer Kathy's question about what conservatives expect to do with all the offspring they would require to be born, here's your answer. They will be fed to the prison industrial complex or just let them die. The babies and their parents are on their own in dealing with health care costs beyond their means. Later, many of these children get put into foster care, are spit out by the system as they go unadopted, become destitute, are punished by the same tough-on-crime conservatives for trying to survive in a society that these kids are unequipped to fit into. Preventing the poor from practicing birth control condemns their children to perpetual poverty. How does this obey Jesus' Sermon on the Mount teachings? The corporatists or fascists then deny their so-called sanctity of life principle to the kids who grow up to be put on death row. The Republicans and religious reactionaries justify the executions by insisting the kids have truly become evil, rotten to the core, with no redeeming value to their continued existence. Under this line of reasoning, don't they have to acknowledge that the ill-fated children never should have been born to begin with? These reactionary corporatists or fascist freaks are also working on making illegal, at the municipal, county, or state level, any Good Samaritan or charitable aid to individuals in actual starvation, or homelessness, or medical, or other dire need. It's easy. Force the debtor's prison chain gangs to herd away the unfortunate, diseased, or injured, dead or dying, much like the 1908 Galveston, Texas hurricane flood victims, whom you informed us about against Ron Paul's laissez-faire principle. Rick and San Leandro. It's just maddening. I mean, it really is. It's just, I can't get over this female Republican legislator in Arizona suggesting that any woman who wants an abortion for whatever reason. Now, again, this crazed Arizona legislator, what is it with you people out there? How do you come up with, is it the desert? I know people that live in the desert. They love the desert. They're normal. What, or is it, I guess it's a Republican thing, isn't it? It's a right-wing thing. But this is utter madness. And I'm sorry to say this, but if you see a picture of this woman who made this suggestion, this legislator, I look at her picture and see craziness in her eyes. It's another Michelle Bachmann crazy eyes thing. How much further are Republicans going to murder their own party? You know it's going to happen in November. I say keep going, but, you know, say these things. Say this crazy stuff. The problem here is that so many legislatures on the state level are in the control of these right-wingers. And the governors are also mad, totally insane, just burbling, gum-chewing, rug-clutching crazy. So the states can pass these laws. And they'll be signed by these crazed right-wing governors. Unbelievable. I wonder if this legislator would feel that way if she or someone in her family, a female, were impregnated against her will by, I don't know, somebody that she might consider not equal to her, say, on a racial basis, maybe? I wonder how she would feel if her father or brother impregnated her against her will. Would she then say, okay, I'm going to have an abortion. First, let me see a live one. I've got to watch one. Okay. Okay, 3, 2, 1, let her go. Ah, well, that's very bloody.
Put me on display.
Pretty good.
I'm impressed.
Talk. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. This is from Ed in Arlington, Washington. He writes, "Hello, Mike and Kathy. I'm a 71-year-old disabled Dom vet. That, of course, does not lend much weight to my story, but it does help to qualify it somewhat. I live in a subsidized senior citizen complex in a semi-rural small town 50 miles north-northeast of Seattle. A group of us were gathered for coffee in the community room the other day, and the conversation eventually got around to religion and, as it often does, became quite heated. I've lived here for over 12 years, and most everyone knows that I do not believe in God, the devil, heaven, or hell. I've always thought that the overtly pious were mostly brainwashed souls, hypnotized from a very young age into a perpetual state of ignorance and lacking any reasoning skills or curiosity whatsoever. However, I wasn't prepared for the astounding gobsmacked stupidity that revealed itself that morning. In order to demonstrate the depth of ignorance in the Christian culture of Texas, I related the following true story that I had heard. I lived in Texas many years ago during the time of a statewide debate considering the idea of teaching both English and Spanish in public schools. In a live telecast of the debate, one of the state's most vocal opponents of the bill and a popular fundamentalist preacher had this to say, in part, justifying and defending his objection. Quote, if English was good enough for Jesus Christ, then it sure is good enough for me in Texas. End quote. So I told that story in the coffee shop and expected some acknowledgement and laughing agreement. I couldn't believe the reaction I saw. The group just sat slack-jawed with their eyes glazed over, and finally one of them said, so? I was flabbergasted, dumbstruck. They actually thought that their imaginary Lord and Savior from Galilee and all the writers of their book of fables actually spoke English? Most of these people were in their 70s and 80s. I know that they went to school. I stammered out that English did not even exist then. Jesus spoke Aramaic, and most of the New Testament was written in Greek. They didn't believe me. They thought that I was an antichrist, church-hating liberal, just spoiling for a fight. I was dazed by their utter stupidity and went on back to my apartment to get my copy of the Oxford History and Etymology of the English Language. Would you believe that these frightened, God-fearing Christians would not even open the book? Of course you would. The Galileo syndrome is alive and well in America. For your legion of right-wing listeners, the Galileo syndrome refers to the prosecution of the famous 16th century Italian physicist, mathematician, astronomer, and philosopher who played a major role in the scientific revolution. His achievements include improvements to the telescope and consequent astronomical observations and support for Copernicanism. The church bishops of that day refused to look through Galileo's telescope to observe the moons circling Jupiter, or sunspots, or comets, and other newly discovered astronomical phenomena that proved that the Earth was not the center of the created universe. They reasoned that, quote, God is perfect and unmovable, hence his creation is also perfect. Therefore, there is no reason to look at something that could not exist. Galileo, of course, was held in house arrest for the rest of his life and was officially recognized by the Catholic Church and absolved of the sin of blasphemy in October of 1992. Thanks for letting me vent, Mike. I weep for this country. Perhaps you will read this on your Wednesday night church show. Ed in Arlington, Virginia. My pleasure, Ed. Thank you. And yes, it is church night. We're not going to overdo it tonight. Tonight's focus is the book of Joshua. we're going to do a little bit of the book of Joshua tonight. But Ed is right. It is Wednesday night. Wednesday night is church night here on the Malloy program. In recognition of the torturous summer Wednesday evenings I spent with my grandparents at prayer meeting in their Baptist church in Findlay, Ohio, listening in awe and wonderment as 20 or 30 adults got on their knees beside straight-backed wooden chairs and prayed mightily for not just President Truman, but for all the sinners and all the things that needed praying for. And they kind of stuck with me, if you know what I mean. So in recognition of those long-ago nights, Wednesday nights in the summer with the cicadas buzzing outside the windows and the sun setting, and little Mikey wrapped up in a warm blanket of terror, we now have church night on the Malloy program. We'll be right back.
Ready for Radical Talk Radio? It's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Clark Morgan. His message, Liberal Talk Radio is the best antidote for hate radio. Thanks, Mike and Kathy. Thank you, Clark. It's time we ran through this again, periodically, I feel compelled to do this. The 14 defining characteristics of fascism, put together by one Dr. Lawrence Britt. I know most of you are thoroughly familiar with this. This particular scholar has examined the fascist regimes of Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, and Suharto, and several Latin American regimes. He found 14 defining characteristics common to each. Now listen, and just tell me if this rings a chime for you, if there is any synchronicity with what Britt wrote and what's happening right now in the United States. I mean, you tell me. Number one, powerful and continuing nationalism. Fascist regimes tend to make constant use of patriotic mottos, slogans, symbols, songs, other paraphernalia. Flags are seen everywhere, as are flag symbols on clothing and in public displays. Number two, disdain for the recognition of human rights. Because of fear of enemies and the need for security, the people in fascist regimes are persuaded that human rights can be ignored in certain cases because of need. The people tend to look the other way or even approve of torture, summary executions, assassinations, long incarcerations of prisoners, and so forth. Number three, identification of enemies or scapegoats as a unifying cause. The people are rallied into a unifying patriotic frenzy over the need to eliminate a perceived common threat or foe. Whether it's racial, ethnic, or religious minorities, liberals, communists, socialists, terrorists, etc. Number four, supremacy of the military. Even when there are widespread domestic problems, the military is given a disproportionate amount of government funding. and the domestic agenda is neglected. Soldiers and military service are glamorized. 5. Rampant sexism. The governments of fascist nations tend to be almost exclusively male-dominated. Under fascist regimes, traditional gender roles are made more rigid. Divorce, abortion, and homosexuality are suppressed, and the state is represented as the ultimate guardian of the family institution. 6, controlled mass media. Sometimes the media is directly controlled by the government, but in other cases, the media is indirectly controlled by government regulation or sympathetic media spokespeople and executives. Censorship, especially in wartime, is very common. 7, obsession with national security. Fear is used as a motivational tool by the government over the masses. 8, religion and government are intertwined. Governments in fascist nations tend to use the most common religion in the nation as a tool to manipulate public opinion. Religious rhetoric and terminology is common from government leaders, even when the major tenets of the religion are diametrically opposed to the government's policies or actions. 9, corporate power is protected. The industrial and business aristocracy of a fascist nation often are the ones who put the government leaders into power, thus creating a mutually beneficial business-slash-government relationship and power elite. 10, labor power is suppressed. Because the organizing power of labor is the only real threat to a fascist government, labor unions are either eliminated entirely or are severely suppressed. 11, disdain for intellectuals and the arts. Fascist nations tend to promote and tolerate open hostility to higher education and academia. It is not uncommon for professors and other academics to be censored or even arrested. Free expression in the arts and letters is openly attacked. 12, obsession with crime and punishment. Under fascist regimes, the police are given almost limitless power to enforce laws. The people are often willing to overlook police abuses and even forego civil liberties in the name of patriotism. There is often a national police force with virtually unlimited power in fascist nations. 13, rampant cronyism and corruption. Fascist regimes almost always are governed by groups of friends and associates who appoint each other to government positions and use government power and authority to protect their friends from accountability. It is not uncommon in fascist regimes for national resources and even treasures to be appropriated or even outright stolen by government leaders. 14, fraudulent elections. Sometimes elections in fascist nations are a complete sham. Other times, elections are manipulated by smear campaigns against or even assassination of opposition candidates. The use of legislation to control voting numbers or political district boundaries, and manipulation of the media. Fascist nations are typically use their judiciaries to manipulate or control elections. So there you have. Now, if we lived in a rational state of being in this country, the 14 defining characteristics of fascism would be posted on the wall in every classroom in America, starting in about the second grade. I think of my daughter Molly. Starting about the second grade, maybe third. And perhaps perhaps at various times during the school year when the subject of social studies is being taught, or principles of self-government, or what have you, somewhere in the sociology teaching, such as it is in those lower grades, reference could be made to those 14 defining characteristics. And the list would be there up on the wall near the chalkboard, perhaps, like so many lists when you were a kid in school and I was a kid in school. Remember that stuff? Anything the teacher really wanted to get you to pay attention to usually hung on the wall. You remember what I'm talking about, I'm sure. But again, if we lived in a nation that was, or in a society, or in a group that was working toward freedom and away from totalitarianism, then the 14 defining characteristics of fascism would be front and center. And when I say working toward freedom, simply because you know that this is not a free society, you know that to be true. I mean, you know it. You absolutely know it. It was not founded on that principle, and it never has been. I mean, it's only been less than, what, about 90 years since women could vote, and now attempts are being made to remove that franchise from them. Minorities, especially black folk in this country, it's only been the past, in most of our lifetimes, okay, not most, I don't know the demographic of the people listening to this program, age basis, but in my lifetime, miscegenation laws were still in effect in this country. Look it up, right winger. No, I'm not going to spell it for you. Poll taxes were still in effect. Jim Crow laws were still in effect. So, you know, working toward freedom, maybe. People who are homosexual still do not have the same constitutional protections as people who are not homosexual, where it concerns the right to do all sorts of things, including making a marriage contract that is authorized by the state. So this is not a free nation. If you think you live in a free nation, you are deluded, or you are a Glenn Beck listener. You do not live in a free nation. Neither do I. We'll be right back.
Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I wanna be just like my president. I wanna make more money than I can spend. I wanna build more bombs than I can send. Somewhere I can even spell the name of. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want a big, big Mac and double fries. I want to wave my American standards high. I want to fly my flag across your sky. Welcome to the new American century.
Can you see out the sky? Look around at the sight and sound.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
Aha, 10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Clark Morgan. Thank you, Clark. His message, Liberal Talk Radio is the best antidote for hate radio. Thanks, Mike and Kathy. Well, thank you, Clark. We appreciate it very much. Truly. Paul Canning, writing at care2.com, talks about the growing outrage over the killing of Trayvon Martin. But it has not stopped, of course, the NRA, another organization of right-wing fascists. There is no other way to define them. They are fascists. From pushing for more states to pass these so-called stand your ground laws, that's the law that under which someone could be shot if the shooter says it was in self-defense. The failure to arrest Trayvon Martin's killer, this George Zimmerman, because of that law, is evoking outrage among Americans, and especially African Americans, as they can identify with Trayvon Martin's family. Jonathan Capehart wrote in the Washington Post, I believe today, was it today or a day or so ago? One of the burdens of being a black male is carrying the heavy weight of other people's suspicions. One minute you're going about your life, the next you could be pleading for it if you're lucky. And far too many aren't. That's why the February 26th killing of Trayvon Martin has black parents around the country clutching their sons a little closer. Mark Thompson from SiriusXM Radio's Make It Plain told Lawrence O'Donnell, quote, by not arresting Zimmerman, and every day that goes by that they don't do that, it really lends credence to the belief, and really to the fact in many ways, that not only do we still have institutional racism here, but they are somehow thinking this is okay and no big deal. Mark Thompson then went on to explain how this has a detrimental effect on the African-American community. Many African Americans are so very, very concerned, it says here, about the value of their lives, and this is not addressed swiftly. And if this is not addressed swiftly and directly, then that concern will remain. This is a little mild. Paul Canning's writing here, but I'll continue. For NPR, the Center for Inspired Teaching's Cosby Hunt writes about clothing advice he plans to give his sons. Quote, we did not plan to give them advice about hoodies, but now I see we'll have to have that talk, too. We will have to say, you know how you used to wear your hooded Batman sweatshirt when you wanted to fight the bad guys as a kid? Well, now that you're older, some people will be confused and think that you're the bad guy if they see your hoodie and your skin color. It's silly and wrong, and anyone would think that you're the bad guys, but we don't want you to be hurt. We don't want the real bad guys or even some guy playing superhero to hurt you. These concerns are being fanned by racist reactions, such as the comments coming from a Fox News story about the shooting. Of course, well, Fox News promotes racism, murder, mayhem, distrust, lies, deceit. That's what Fox News, that's their function. According to Mother Jones, Florida courts have found that under the Stand Your Ground statute, quote, a defendant's only burden is to offer facts from which his resort to force could have been reasonable. While the state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense. The law has been unpopular with law enforcement officers in Florida since it makes it much more difficult to charge shooters with a crime. And it has regularly confounded juries in murder cases. Many Orlando area cops reportedly have given up investigating self-defense cases, so-called, as a result of this law, referring them to the overloaded state attorney's office for action. A 2010 study by the Tampa Bay Times found that, quote, justifiable homicides, so-called, had tripled in the state since the law went into effect. Are you listening? Former Washington, D.C. Police Department homicide investigator Rod Wheeler told Fox News that the Stand Your Ground law was really the Make My Day law. He said, quote, the police department in Sanford, Florida, where the young man was killed, opposed the law. What that law is saying in the state of Florida, and look at the case law, you can actually shoot a dog. It happens all the time. You can shoot and kill a dog and get arrested and put in jail. But if you kill a kid, and especially a black kid in Florida, you can walk away. That's what this law means. You can shoot and kill a dog and get arrested and put in jail. But if you shoot and kill a kid, and especially a black kid in Florida, you can walk away. You can shoot and kill a dog and get arrested and put in jail. But if you kill a kid, and especially a black kid in Florida, you can walk away. That's what this law is all about. That's what the NRA is doing to the country. That's what the right-wingers are doing to black people. It never stops. In Florida, you can actually shoot a dog. You can kill a dog and get arrested and get put in jail. But if you kill a kid, especially a black kid in Florida, you can walk away. Did you hear me? In Florida, you can shoot and kill a dog and get arrested and be put in jail. But if you kill a kid, and especially a black kid in Florida, you can walk away. Did you hear me on that? Can you hear me on that? The hour coming up at the bottom of this hour, a moment with Bob. Hope I can work it in. And next hour, Uncle Mike's Story Corner. This hour is sponsored by David Record. His message: give him hell, Mike. You have my support. Love your show. Hate the Christian right. I called them the Talibangelists. Televangelists. Oh, that's a good one. It's only a matter of time before they will be demanding that women wear burqas and accept female circumcision. These monsters have to be stopped. When will the general public finally understand that there is no safe level of capitalism? It will always end up raping and pillaging. I don't know. Thank you, David, for the sponsorship and a great message. I don't know. You know, that's the question I ask on this program all the time. What does it take to wake people up? Sometimes nothing. They spend their whole lives in a coma and then they die, and they never really fully awake. And I realize that. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. All you have to do is keep your eyes and ears open. I think I figured that out some point in the 80s. It occurred to me that so many people, and I realize this sounds a little bit arrogant and a little bit condescending, but I'm sorry. I'm stuck with what I'm stuck with. But I noticed that so many people seem to be living their lives not necessarily quite desperation or, something that a poet has said, but just totally non-conscious, just unconscious of anything other than the poison that was pumped into them in their childhood or their adolescence. And they just relate to that poison and are never, ever, ever fully awake. And the problem, of course, is so many of those people are in positions of power. Right? It is church night. I hate church night. But there's something I do want to share with you. First, an email here from Bruce. He writes, Christians worship Jesus as a God, so they don't have to listen to what he said. You see, gods are magic. And if you convince people who don't understand the magic that you do, You can do whatever you want. The religious are only interested in the basics of life, that is, power, money, status, and sex. Depending on the niche of the individual, these things aren't approached in this order, but all are desired, if not for their own sake, then for the satisfaction gained by denying them to others. Isn't that the truth? And Daniel, who lives in the Soviet of Seattle, writes, you might be interested to know that a Pew survey shows some 38% of Americans think there's too much expression of religious faith and prayer from political leaders. By contrast, 30% of the Christlings surveyed said there's too little religious expression by politicians, and 25% says it's just about right. What might be most significant about the 38% who say enough is that it's been steadily growing since 2001, when Pew began this particular survey. Furthermore, much to my amazement, Daniel writes, self-described Republicans who claim to be uneasy with religious talk has grown from 8% in 2001 to 24% today. Well, yeah, but that's still 76%, Daniel, that say it's okay. He goes on, can it be that the United States is slowly coming to its senses? Can it be that the self-designated piety of Christling clowns like Rick Santorum is gradually coming to turn off voters, even those in his own benighted party? Can it possibly be that I won't have to fall back on my dual Spanish-American citizenship and hightail it to Barcelona after all? Well, I guess we better wait and see. Daniel, who is now living in the Soviet of Seattle. 1 Samuel 15, verses 2 and 3. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek, and utterly destroy all that he has, and don't spare him. Put him to death, both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. But from the book of Joshua, Joshua 1, Joshua receives the Lord's blessing for all the bloody endeavors to follow. Joshua 6, with the Lord's approval, Joshua destroys the city of Jericho, the men, women, children, and babies with the edge of the sword. Joshua 7, Achan, his children, and his cattle are stoned to death because Achan has taken a taboo thing. Joshua 8, with the Lord's approval, Joshua utterly smites the people of Ai, killing 12,000 men and women, so that there were none who escaped. Joshua 10, with the help of the Lord, Joshua utterly destroys the Gibeonites. Joshua 10, with the Lord's approval, Joshua utterly destroys the people of Makkedah. Joshua 10, with the Lord's approval, Joshua utterly destroys the Libnahites. Joshua 10, with the Lord's approval, Joshua utterly destroys the people of Lachish. Joshua 10, with the Lord's approval, Joshua utterly destroys the Eglonites. Joshua 10, with the Lord's approval, Joshua utterly destroys the Hebronites. Joshua 10, with the Lord's approval, Joshua utterly destroys the Deborahites. Joshua 10. So Joshua defeated the whole land. He left nothing remaining, but destroyed all that breathed, as the Lord God of Israel commanded. Joshua 11, the Lord orders the horses to be hamstrung. Joshua 11, and the Lord gave them into the land, into the hand of Israel, utterly destroying them. There was none left that breathed. Joshua 11, for it was the Lord's doing to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, in order that they should be utterly destroyed and should receive no mercy, but be exterminated, as the Lord commanded Moses. Joshua utterly destroys the Anakim. With the Lord's support, Judah defeats 10,000 Canaanites at Bezek. With the Lord's approval, Judah pursues Adoni-Bezek, catches him and cuts off his thumbs and big toes. With the Lord's approval, Judah smites Jerusalem. With the Lord's approval, Judah and Simeon utterly destroy the Canaanites who inhabited Zepheth. The Israelites kill 10,000 Moabites. The Gideons slaughter the men of Penuel. Abimelech murders his brothers. Judges 9. A woman dropped a stone on his head and cracked his skull. Hurriedly, he called to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and kill me, so that they can't say a woman killed me." So his servant ran him through and he died. Judges 11. Jephthah sacrifices his beloved daughter, his only child, according to a vow he's made with the Lord. Samson slays 1,000 men with the jawbone of an ass. The Philistines gouge out Samson's eyes. Is there a point? This is church night. Judges 19. A group of sexually depraved men, beat on the door of an old man's house, demanding that he turn over to them a male house guest. Instead, the old man offers his virgin daughter and his guest's concubine. He says, "Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now. Ravish them and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do no such vile a thing." The man's concubine is ravished and dies. The man then cuts her body into 12 pieces and sends one piece to each of the 12 tribes of Israel. This is church night, Kathy. Damn.
Against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. I know. That's just a little tribal warfare going on there in the history of the Jews and in the Christian Bible. I find it very... very interesting. That's one pissed off God. Whoo! I mean, I used to think that some of the other gods from mythology were fairly brutal. But nothing like the Judeo-Christian God. That one is a real sword swinger, if you know what I mean. I mean, holy Toledo. It just goes on and on and on. I used to ask my grandmother about that. My fundamentalist Southern Baptist Christian grandmother. She didn't like me to read the Old Testament. she preferred that part B. Except Job. She liked Job and Genesis and Exodus. But, you know, when you get into the really good stuff, she didn't like the part about Abraham sacrificing his son, and well, you know. But her forte was the New Testament. She tried to tell me that the Old Testament was written by people who worshipped this horrific, violent God, and that when Jesus was born, the old God changed. And I found that, you know, kind of fascinating. I didn't know that gods could do that, that they would change. The other gods that I eventually came to hear about, they never changed. Of course, when I was a kid, I didn't know about the Greeks and the Romans and other Middle Eastern and Asian and Native American and indigenous people gods from all over the place. I kind of liked what I found out about the Aborigine people in Australia, that there's no difference to them between sleeping and awake, dead and alive. It's all just one flow. I mean, that's I like that. But Grandma tried to steer me away from, the Old Testament part of the Bible. I certainly can understand why. Explaining to me who is the I'm drawing one of those senior moments, Kathy, the pillar of salt man, Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot, thank you. Just couldn't think of the word Lot. If my grandma would have tried to explain to me why Lot had sexual relations with first one daughter and then the next, two nights back to back, belly to belly, and got them both pregnant, it would be, and wine was involved. I mean, my grandma was a teetotaler, man. Wine, beer, that's devil's serum. You stay away from that. Woo! So, the Old Testament was kind of off limits. That was the one that, But these are the books of the Bible, you see, that the religious fundamentalists in this country suck up the most. That's the problem. When you hear Santorum, or some of the creepy death cult people he hangs out with in their temples of destruction and cannibalism, this is the part that they go for. They go for the blood and gore and death and destruction and dismemberment. When you get to those parts about, Joshua or whoever the Israelite was, or the Hebrew was, who was instructed by Almighty God to go in and kill folks. And, when this Old Testament God talked about killing, are you kidding me? He didn't mean, okay, go defeat their army. He meant defeat their army, kill their men, their leadership, their women, rip the unborn child out of the pregnant women, butcher the unborn child, butcher the old people, get the dogs, the cats, the rats, the oxen, the asses, the cows, burn their fields, burn their houses, stomp out their olive orchards, destroy everything. Then get back to me, let me know, how you did. And if you destroyed everything, then I'll bless you. Then I'll pat you on the head and say, good killer. Good killer. That's the religion that Rick Santorum and these religious right so-called Christian fundamentalists in this country follow. They love this stuff, man. I mean, look at the, what was that, the one that, about Christ getting beaten, what's his name did? No, not The Last Temptation. That was when the passion of, was that what it was? They love that. Beat me, flay me, rip the skin off my body. Ah, religion porn.
Really can be fascinating.
Oh, he just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, blah, 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 in the Malloy chat room, one of our Canadian co-conspirators posted, goes by the name Stoon, posted In the Bible, marriage is between one man, 700 wives, 300 concubines, and one condiment. One man, 700 wives. Hey, Rick Santorum! Oh, my God. All right. It's time. Listen closely. Do you hear anything? It's time once again for A Moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. The title of tonight's episode is Where Are the Grown-Ups? Hey, Mike! We could buy real fireworks for the 4th of July because we live near the Port Madison Indian Reservation in Washington State. No wimpy sparklers for us. None of that safe and sane garbage. These were definitely unsafe and insane. We could buy stuff that exploded. As SCTV's Billy Saul Hurock and Big Jim McBob used to say, it blowed up real good. I was about to set off a rocket slightly smaller than a cruise missile when I noticed a warning on the box. Use under adult supervision. Well, I guess that would be me. A crazed adolescent in an aging body with an arsenal of dangerous, albeit colorful, explosives. I lit the fuse and ran. It shot up a couple of hundred feet and kabam! A pyrotechnic chrysanthemum lit up the sky over our house with a sonic boom that rattled our windows. Another successful 4th of July! Nothing caught on fire and everybody still had all their fingers. And as we walked back to the house, I realized I finally looked old enough to do all the stuff I couldn't possibly get away with as a teenager. The only difference between 15-year-old Bob and 60-year-old Bob is the older one knows he's not bulletproof. What might pass for wisdom is just having a better handle on cause and effect. If you pay attention, even slightly, for 40 years or so, you realize it's not a good idea to do all sorts of things. Left to my own devices, for example, my diet would consist entirely of meat, potatoes, and bread. For breakfast, add a couple of fried eggs. For lunch, put some meat in between two slices of bread and slather on the mayonnaise. For dinner, fry everything, or better yet, deep fat fry everything. The only other vegetable necessary would be corn on the cob or popped. Either way is fine with me, as long as there's plenty of salt and butter. Not a bad diet if you want the blood vessels in your brain to blow out like bald tires on a bad road. Since I want to live long enough to see everybody graduate from college, get married, and bring the kids around to see Grandpa every once in a while, the 15-year-old Bob hasn't been in charge of menu planning for years. And that meant coming to terms with broccoli and cauliflower and fruit smoothies and cramming bushels of vegetables into our juicer. It must be working because my doctor told me my blood pressure was great for someone my age. When it comes to health issues, I'm pretending to be a mature adult individual. If you saw me at the organic market, you'd see me outwardly making all the right choices. But inside I'm thinking, screw the goddamn vegetables. I don't care if they were watered with the tears of virginal angels. I want an effing cheeseburger! But I pick up a head of cabbage, put it in the cart, and wonder how much I'll have to choke down because it's an excellent source of vitamin C with significant amounts of glutamine, an amino acid that has anti-inflammatory properties. You see, I know I'm faking it. I am a pretend adult. In social situations, surrounded by people I don't know, I am not being thoughtful. I'm just talking slowly. We're going to go to a big deal dinner tonight. I have to break out a coat and find my tie. My time limit is about an hour and a half, 2 hours tops. After that, it takes an incredible amount of self-control to not blurt out things that definitely will put a damper on polite conversation. Things like, if you truly believe what you're saying, you're out of your goddamn mind! That one's applicable for any conservative junior booster or religious nut job. Oh, and my definition of a religious nut job? That's anyone who believes the tenets of any religion. I have a sneaking suspicion that most so-called adults are faking it too. And after 20 years or more, they get so good at it, they can do it all day long. And that's the primary reason mental illness strikes 11 out of 10 people. People can't continually pretend to be something they're not all day long, every day, without blowing their wheels somewhere along the line. Sometimes the snapping point is pretty dramatic. Texas tower sniper Charles Whitman comes to mind, but most of the time it's a subtle, gradual transformation where people begin to believe more and more in the carefully constructed facade of their own adulthood. They believe in things that aren't true at all. It doesn't help when the entire culture aids and abets these insane beliefs. We live with it all the time. Our previous mechanic seemed like a normal person until we noticed he had Fox News running constantly on the TV in his shop. He was getting his cues on how to behave and talk like an adult about current events from a crazy squawk box. The finest examples happen like clockwork. Every couple of years, about a half dozen people believe so deeply in their own BS, they somehow manage to get in front of a television camera and announce they should be the next president of the United States. For the next 18 months, they roam around the country spending millions of dollars putting forth their image of what they think a mature adult individual capable of handling the job of the most powerful person in the world looks and sounds like. Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, Ron Paul. Each and every one is far crazier than the rent is too damn high parties, Jimmy McMillan. And we do not want him anywhere near the big red button. During the Gore-Bush debates in 2000, George W. Bush only proved he had partial knowledge of the alphabet and bladder and sphincter control. But that was enough for the millions of Americans who voted for him. This is what happens when there aren't any grown-ups around. To paraphrase Tom Lehrer, Americans have gone from adolescence to senility, bypassing maturity. If I had the answers, hell, if I had one answer, I'd certainly tell you. The only thing I can come up with is end the wars, tax the rich, vote for Pedro. And if you haven't seen it, go rent Napoleon Dynamite. Regards, Bob. Another in a seemingly endless supply of Moments with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. I wonder how that party's coming. It's only 7:42 in the evening where Bob Alexander is, so I guess if he's at a dinner party, they're just about now sitting down to dinner. And I'll bet it's something with lots of broccoli and cauliflower in it, too. What do you want to bet? This hour has been, or is being, I should say, sponsored by David Record. His message, give him hell, Mike. You have my support. Love your show. Hate the Christian right. I call them the televangelists. It's a hard one to say. Televangelists. There you go. It is only a matter of time, David writes, before they will be demanding that women wear burqas and accept female circumcision. These monsters have to be stopped. When will the general public finally understand that there is no safe level of capitalism? It will always, always end up raping and pillaging. Yeah, by definition. What was it that... Oh, yeah, we'll do that later. Oh, Alec Baldwin is getting into the name-calling business. It's not just talk radio. He took to his Twitter page over the weekend to unload on James Inhofe, this crazy bastard Republican senator from Oklahoma. And he repeatedly referred to Inhofe, who's notoriously anti-environment, anti-life, pro-death, strictly pro-death, pro-planet destruction, pro-murder of the environment. That's Inhofe. And Baldwin kept referring to him as an oil whore. Now, I'm not sure what an oil whore is. It sounds you know, kind of slippery and a little bit sexy when you get right down to it, but an oil whore. During an environmentally focused diatribe against BP and fossil fuel dependence, Baldwin launched the following jab at Inhofe. The senator is a noted climate... Oh, no, wait. The senator's noted climate change denier, who's also recently drew the fire of Robert F. Kennedy, who attacked the senator as Big Oil's top call girl earlier this month. But this is what Alec tweeted. Oil whore Jim Inhofe has betrayed every man and woman who lost their livelihood on the Gulf due to BP's overwhelming negligence. And it goes on. There are a bunch of tweets where, Baldwin just unloaded on him. We'll be right back.
Show all substance, no abuse.
Ten before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by David Record. And David's message, give him hell, Mike. You have my support. Love your show. Hate the Christian right. I call them the televangelists. It's only a matter of time before they will be demanding that women wear burqas and accept female circumcision. These monsters have to be stopped. When will the general public finally understand that there is no safe level of capitalism? It will always end up raping and pillaging. It will indeed. David, thank you for the sponsorship. A lot of poor, idiotic, brain-dead right-wingers send me emails sometimes. They say, well, your program runs on capitalism. No, it doesn't, moron. You understood the terms. I don't even, you know, we have an algorithm that we have woven into the email program here at the Malloy compound, thanks to the magic of our secret advisor. And it spits out, for certain emails, it spits out a very interesting automated response. I love it. From Lee in NYC. Lee writes, this is from a Reuters article I found on Huffington Post. Quote, Utah's Republican governor signed a law extending a required waiting period for women seeking an abortion to 72 hours on Tuesday, even though a similar requirement in South Dakota has been blocked in court, a spokeswoman said. End quote. Mike Lee writes, it makes me wonder who will be the first Republican to demand a 9-month waiting period. Being male, I freely admit that my knowledge of abortion will always be limited. I do believe that for the vast majority of women, the decision is not hasty. To delay the path from decision to action is ridiculous. The only way that I could consider a woman quickly deciding to abort when there is no crime or health issue is when abortion is her chosen method of contraception. To such a person, the delay will not change the decision. Abstinence-only sex education, discouragement of proactive contraceptive methods, battles over the morning after options, denials of insurance coverage, safety risk to any doctor willing to stand by the patient in need clearly shows the choice by these legislators pundits and their supporters that women should have no choice. As you have often said, how can any woman vote Republican? To paraphrase William Gladstone, abortion delayed is abortion denied. I would expect that that legislator will soon demand a waiting period for criticism. Waiting for sanity, Lee in NYC. And I haven't commented here recently on the atrocities being committed in the occupied territory of Palestine. But there was a horrible school bus accident near Jerusalem last Thursday in which 10 children died and 40 were injured. And once it was determined that all the deaths and injuries were Palestinian children, the bloodbath on Facebook and Twitter and various websites in Israel began. According to Haaretz newspaper, racial comments appeared on Prime Minister Netanyahu's Facebook page after the school bus crash near Jerusalem, in which 10 children died and more than 40 were injured. Satisfaction that, quote, only Palestinians, end quote, were the victims, and slogans such as, quote, death to Arabs, why do we help them, end quote, were posted on the Facebook pages of Netanyahu, Walla, and the Israel police. Other comments included, quote, can we send another truck? The school bus had been hit by a truck. And I'd send a double trailer to wipe out all those blanks after the bus overturned when it crashed into a truck. Netanyahu expressed sorrow over the accident, but his aides did not remove the racist comments from his Facebook page or denounce them. Someone wrote on Walla's Facebook page, quote, relax, it's only Palestinian children. Others wrote, great, fewer terrorists. And may there be such buses every day. Similar comments were posted on the police Facebook page, including, when they grew up, they'd be terrorists. God nipped them in the bud. Netanyahu's aides declined to comment. Walla site editor Gadi Lahav said, quote, we monitor the page every few minutes and delete unworthy comments like these, end quote. That's according to Haaretz newspaper in Israel. Church night. Or mosque night. Or synagogue night. Or temple night, or whatever. It's a little bit hard to deal with sometimes, you know what I'm saying? Church night. All right, we have a break here, and we'll come back. Uncle Mike's Story Corner, next segment, so hang around. It's quite an interesting story. We haven't done that for a while, Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Press the Hour, the Malloy program. As promised, in a moment, Uncle Mike's Story Corner. We haven't done that for quite some time, but since it is spring, we thought we would amuse and delight you with an Uncle Mike Story Corner. This hour is being sponsored by Bruce Reynolds. Thanks, Bruce. His message, happy birthday to my Kathy. She makes me listen in the garage because Mike gets me so worked up. She makes me listen in the garage because Mike gets me so worked up, so she won't hear this. But I will, if I'm not howling at the moon by hour three. Oh, I see. Really? Kathy makes you? Well, anyway, happy birthday to Bruce's Kathy. Thanks, Bruce. Makes you listen in the garage, huh? That's all right, you know. It's better than not being allowed to listen, period. It's time, once again, Truth Seekers, for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Everybody comfy? It's pretty late. Huh? All the kids are in bed. Everybody comfy in their jammies? Well, you know, spring sprung a couple days ago, so Uncle Mike thought he would entertain and delight you with a story by Jennifer Brody Hernandez. This appeared in Common Dreams today. Silent spring dawns hot, dry, and merciless. Oh, it's going to be one of those stories. Jennifer writes, this week, turning the corner into the astronomical spring, we have gone abruptly from warm winter to hot summer. And I mean hot. It was 84 degrees Fahrenheit in western Massachusetts today, brightly sunny with puffy white cumulus clouds against a brilliant blue sky, unobstructed by any leaves. No shade. Today reminded me of a wax model, beautiful but blank. The facade of beauty with the crucial vital spark missing. When I went for a walk up the mountain early this morning, the woods were eerily silent. I remembered mournfully the spring mornings of my childhood, where I would be awakened by the joyful singing of the dawn chorus of thousands of birds, each happily greeting each other and the new day. Reaching the top of the mountain, having heard only the distant cry of a single phoebe, I stopped to sit on a rock and listen for a few minutes. All I heard was the dim rustling of the traffic on the road far below me and the drone of an airplane churning its way across the sky. Coming down again, a few chipmunks hurried out of sight along the path, and I was keenly aware that there were no acorns underfoot, despite the oak trees towering overhead. Last fall was a terrible year for acorns, so all the animals that depend on them for overwintering must be very hungry now. I know the bears are on the move, as one came and pulled down my bird feeder yesterday. I'm thinking of bringing some sunflower seeds along on my walk tomorrow to spread by the path as an offering of atonement. While no one of us can shoulder personal responsibility for this tragedy of the commons, all of us who have benefited from the heedless extraction of oil and relentless destruction of the forests and the oceans must be aware of the extent to which we have brought this on ourselves and taken the rest of the natural world along with us. Will there come a day when the sun rises in the brilliant blue sky and looks down on a hot, dry planet, silent except for the hardiest of species, like the cockroaches and the ants who survived previous major extinction events, and will once again continue about their business single-mindedly, able to wait out the eons while life reboots and resurges again anew? This weekend, I had a chance to see the new documentary film by Pamela Yates, Granito, How to Nail a Dictator, which powerfully makes the point that the genocide in Guatemala was about land rights, with U.S.-backed military juntas working for the landowners and the corporations to clear the land of indigenous people and peasants so that big internationally funded projects like dams and mines could proceed unobstructed. 200,000 people, mostly indigenous Mayans, were massacred in the 70s and 80s in the service of the American-fueled greed in Guatemala alone. It strikes me that this story is repeating now, if indeed it ever stopped, as we continue to fight over resources and land on our finite planet. It is happening now in the forests of Indonesia, where on the island of Sumatra, plantations the size of the United Kingdom, the size of Belgium, unimaginably huge tracts of magnificent rainforests with some of the richest stores of biodiversity on the planet, are being bulldozed and replaced with palms to feed international demand for palm oil. The indigenous people who made the forest their home for millennia are being mercilessly deprived of their natural habitat, just as surely as the rest of the flora and fauna there. The loss of biodiversity, including the loss of ancient indigenous human cultures, is a tragedy that cannot be quantified. What is being lost is priceless. It's all very sad, you may say, but all very far away, too. But our summer temperatures in March have everything to do with the destruction of the last remaining old-growth forests in Indonesia, in Africa, in South America, in Canada. Once the forest is gone, the topsoil will begin to erode. Desert will prowl the borders of what used to be forest. When, as in Indonesian palm oil plantations, when diverse ecosystems are replaced with monocultures, those monocultures become more vulnerable to pest and climate disruption. And then? Lately, I have been having recurring waking nightmares about food shortages. Already, I'm concerned, as a backyard gardener, that these hot, dry spring days will not provide the proper growing conditions for spring crops like peas and lettuce. Imagine conditions like these being replicated across the globe. Imagine a growing season where, all over the planet, we lurched from heat and drought to torrential rains and tornadoes. In the U.S., we have become accustomed to thinking of food insecurity as something that happens in other parts of the world. Famine stalks Africa and Asia. It doesn't come near us. This year, as I see how the natural world around me is struggling to provide for the chipmunks, the bears, and the turkeys, as I greet the arrival of the few straggling migrant birds who have managed to run the gauntlet of a landscape devastated by chemical warfare and industrial agriculture, as I gaze out at the bare trees shimmering in the unnatural midday heat, I know in my heart that it is only a matter of time before our turn comes. Today, it is the indigenous people of Indonesia who are going down with their forests. It is the desert people of North Africa who are starving, and the teeming masses of Asia who are fleeing the floods of torrential rains. We in the huge, pampered, gated communities of North America and Europe will be insulated from these shocks for much longer than those on the outside. But our time will come. And when it comes, it will be with the full force of every violent, futuristic film we've ever dreamed up. Waterworld, anyone? Mad Max? Usually, I try to stay positive and keep the flame of hope burning brightly, a beacon for myself and for others. But today, this stark, in-your-face, first day of spring evidence of the coming train wreck of climate change has guttered my hope. Time is running short for us, just as it is for the bears and the birds and the native peoples of the forest. We are coming inexorably into Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Tonight's by Jennifer Brody De Hernandez. She teaches comparative literature and gender studies at Bard College at Simon's Rock in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. She also blogs at Transition Times. Uncle Mike's Story Corner, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling.
Cool.
listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
Twenty-one past the hour. So the Keystone XL pipeline abomination is squirming around just beneath everyone's consciousness right now, right? Except for people like Bill McKibben, who keeps track of these sorts of things on an hourly basis, whereas you and I pretty much only pay attention when all of a sudden we get an email alert from an environmental group or from McKibben himself about, here we go again. Well, here we go again. According to Common Dreams, even though Barack Obama denied a permit for the main Keystone XL pipeline from Canada's tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico a couple of months ago, it is expected that he will announce tomorrow, on a visit to Cushing, Oklahoma, a plan to speed up the permit for the southern section of the Keystone XL pipeline, which would carry these, or this crude tar sands oil from Cushing, Oklahoma, to Port Arthur, Texas. Noah Greenwald of the Center for Biological Diversity said today, quote, Keystone XL may be a boon to big oil companies in the exporting business, but those profits will come at a stiff price for our land, water, wildlife, and climate. Greenwald added, building Keystone XL in pieces doesn't make it any less dangerous, end quote. And if you notice, around dinner time, the woman in black continues, the spokeswoman for the American Petroleum Institute continues to casually walk in her high heels across your TV screen. She in black and everything else in a pristine white, for the most part, as she explains to us, million jobs would be created, energy independence for the United States, because, ooh, the energy industry in this country is doing so much to make us energy independent, including those precious tar sands oil in Canada, which will fuel American homes. I mean, every night, the lies, every single night. God knows how much this spokeswoman is making for the Petroleum Institute, but she has to know she is either participating in the destruction of her own planet. She can't be so abysmally ignorant. And she must understand that the money she's being paid to be the spokesmodel for API is money that eventually she may have to use for respiratory therapy. But I digress. CNN reports Obama to fast-track southern half of the Keystone XL pipeline. President Barack Obama plans to announce in Cushing, Oklahoma, Thursday that his administration will expedite the permit for the southern half of the Keystone XL pipeline, a source familiar with the president's announcement, tells CNN. From the Texas Tribune. Obama to talk about Keystone XL pipeline in Oklahoma this week. A White House official confirmed Tuesday that the president on Thursday will, quote, reiterate his administration's commitment to expediting the construction of a pipeline from Cushing, Oklahoma to the Gulf of Mexico, relieving a bottleneck of oil and carrying domestic resources to market, end quote. Carrying domestic resources, that's oil drilled in this country, to market, that's to the export zones in Houston. Well, what do you mean, Mike? It's not going to be used here? Doesn't sound like it, does it, Booby? From the Guardian of the UK, Suzanne Goldenberg writes, on two-day energy tour, U.S. President is expected to hasten building of southern section of tar sands line out of Canada. Barack Obama is expected to speed up approval of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline on Thursday after taking to the road with what the White House is billing as an, quote, all of the above end quote, energy tour. Huh? Obama's planned visit to the oil hub of Cushing, Oklahoma, on day two of the energy tour has raised expectations that he will speed up approval of the southern U.S.-only segment of the pipeline running from the town of Port Arthur, Texas. The approval, which would infuriate environmental groups, only them, could allow construction on that portion to begin before November's presidential election instead of next year. Obama's tour starts with a visit to the country's biggest operating solar farm in Boulder City, Nevada. The White House said in a statement, quote, "The president will highlight his administration's focus on diversifying our energy portfolio, including expanding renewable energy from sources like wind and solar, with thanks in part to investments made by this administration to which are set to double in the president's first term," end quote. More here when we return. All you have to do.
Redefining anger management. Back to Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Bruce Reynolds. His message is, happy birthday to my Kathy. She makes me listen in the garage because Mike gets me so worked up. So she won't hear this dedication, but I will if I'm not howling at the moon by hour three. Well, happy birthday to Kathy. Bruce, thanks for the sponsorship. Really. So, a compendium, a synopsis, whatever you want to call it, of quick reports on Barack Obama, who apparently tomorrow will be in Cushing, Oklahoma, to announce that, yes, the Keystone XL pipeline moves forward. You know, the Kenyan socialist foreign Muslim who will do anything in his power to destroy the energy industry is going to promote the energy industry. These goddamn Republicans, I swear, anything, any lie, any distortion, it doesn't make any difference. But I digress. So we've heard from CNN and the Texas Tribune. We are listening now to Suzanne Goldenberg of The Guardian of the UK. As she points out that his visit to Cushing will have a little side tour to the country's biggest operating solar farm in Boulder City, Nevada, to pretend like this administration is really, really, truly, truly, seriously, seriously, no kidding, honest to goodness, cross my heart, hope to die, interested in solar energy. But as Susan writes, the visit seemed a detour on a trip apparently solidly focused on fossil fuels and the price of gas at the pump. Ooh, Barack Obama's going to bring down the price of gas at the pump? Well, Newt Gingrich would. How is Barack Obama going to do that? I know, with a magic wand given to him by the forest fairies of Indonesia. Whoosh! And the price will come down. Obama has been under nonstop attack from Republicans for rising petrol prices, which now stand at well over $4 for a U.S. gallon in some parts of the country, and for his decision in January to halt the pipeline because of a section running through an ecologically sensitive part of Nebraska. On the campaign trail, Newt Gingrich has said he would cut gas prices to $2.50 a gallon if he's elected president, and Mitt Romney has taken to demanding Obama sack his energy secretary, Stephen Chu, the interior secretary, Ken Salazar, and his environmental protection administrator, Lisa Jackson. Gingrich calls the three the Gas Hike Trio. Ta-da! Ta-da-da-da-da! But Obama's forthcoming speech at a pipe yard owned by TransCanada, the Canadian company behind the project to pump crude from the tar sands of Alberta, was seen as a strong signal that the pipeline, at least the portion running from Cushing to Port Arthur, Texas, the pipeline is back on track. The White House said last month it would allow the southern portion, which requires no State Department approval, to go ahead. It was not immediately clear how Obama would push the process along further. TransCanada has said it will go ahead with the Cushing to Port Arthur segment of the pipeline as soon as it gets the go-ahead from the Army Corps of Engineers. The White House said in a statement Obama's visiting Cushing was intended to show his commitment to, quote, improving and supporting the infrastructure that helps us leverage our domestic resources while also ensuring these projects are developed in a safe and responsible way, end quote. The statement continued, quote, this includes a pipeline that will transport oil from Cushing to the Gulf of Mexico, which will help address the bottleneck of oil that has resulted in large part from increased domestic oil production in the Midwest, end quote. Increased domestic oil production in the Midwest, a glut of oil. But, never mind. Fast-tracking a portion of the pipeline would be a huge disappointment for a broad coalition of activists who have campaigned against the project, framing it as a test of Obama's green credentials, end quote, the Guardian of the UK. From Bill McKibben. Amidst the many environmental disappointments of the Obama administration, which include the fizzled Copenhagen conference, the opening of vast swatches of the Arctic to drilling and huge stretches of federal land across the northern plains to coal mining, the failure to work for climate legislation in the Senate, the shameful blocking of regulations to control ozone, the president has done one somewhat brave thing. He responded to the largest outpouring of environmental enthusiasm so far this millennium and denied a permit for the main Keystone XL pipe from Canada's tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Cynics said he did so just to avoid disappointing young people before the election, and pointed out that he invited pipeline proponent TransCanada to reapply for the permit. It's hard not to wonder if those cynics might be right, now that he's going to Oklahoma, to laud the southern half of the project, just as TransCanada executives have requested. True, the most critical part of the pipeline still can't be built, thanks to Obama and 42 Democratic senators. The connection to Canada remains blocked, and hence that remains a great victory for the people who rallied so fiercely all last fall, but the sense grows that Obama may be setting us up for a bitter disappointment, that his real allegiance is to the carbon barons. End quote, Bill McKibben. Oh, it's just all so confusing, isn't it? What's the president going to do? From the Center for Biological Diversity. The headline, Obama trumpets dirty fuel pipeline that will allow global export of tar sands oil worsen climate crisis. Quote, the Gulf Coast leg would add to the fossil fuel infrastructure at a time when we critically need to transition away from fossil fuels in order to avoid climate catastrophe, said Noah Greenwald at the Center for Biological Diversity. Just like Keystone, he continued, the Gulf Coast leg of Keystone XL will spill, polluting land and water, ruining important habitat for endangered species like the whooping crane, the piping plover, the American burying beetle, the interior least tern, and the Arkansas River shiner. Greenwald added, the president's support for this pipeline is troubling. Keystone XL may be a boon to big oil companies in the exporting business, but those profits will come at a stiff price for our land, water, wildlife, and climate. The American people, Greenwald concluded, have spoken clearly against this project. Building Keystone XL in pieces doesn't make it any less dangerous, end quote. Ta-da, ta-da. When when the list here, Noah Greenwald's list of species that are endangered with this pipeline, he lists the whooping crane, the piping plover, the American burying beetle, the interior least term, and the Arkansas river shiner. He leaves out Homo sapiens. He leaves out the citizens of not just the United States, a false construct if ever there was one, but citizens of the world. I'm sure it was just an oversight on the part of Mr. Greenwald. Don't you think? So, there you have it. This occurs tomorrow. We shall watch and report as we always do. But the environmental president, or the president who claimed that or something, I don't know, is going to Cushing, Oklahoma to at his benediction, his blessing. I don't know how you do that in Islam since he's a Muslim, but he, I don't know, will he make the sign of the outline of Mecca or Medina? I don't know exactly how that's done. I know how the Christians do it. I'm not sure how the Jews do it either. So since Obama is a Kenyan born in some place and a Muslim, and he's going there to bless and offer his benediction over this wonderful job-creating, millions of jobs, by the way, pipeline, this leg that goes from Cushing, Oklahoma to Port Arthur, Texas, to an export zone. Interesting, they would ship it to an export zone. Gosh, sending it to Detroit, do you have to export? Sending it to New York City, do you have to export? I don't understand. I just don't. Because we all know, just like the lady in black on the American Petroleum Institute promotional videos every night on your TV, just as she says, the oil from the Keystone XL excavation is going to benefit Americans. She couldn't be lying, could she? The president of the United States couldn't be deceiving, could he? Nah. Before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Bruce Reynolds. Thank you, Bruce. His message, happy birthday to my Kathy. She makes me listen in the garage because Mike gets me so worked up, so she won't hear this, but I will if I'm not howling at the moon by hour three. Well, hour three is just about over. Bruce, are you howling? Thanks, Bruce, and happy birthday to Kathy. Thank you very much. The other night in, I think it was Monday night, at a reception in New York City, that was hosted by Robert De Niro, the actor, and his wife. Reception for the Obamas. First Lady Michelle Obama attended. And De Niro told the crowd of about 90 people who were at this reception fundraiser. I'm sure it was a fundraiser. De Niro was making some comments, and he was being a funny man. Now, this is something right-wingers, miserable, these miserable, constipated right-wingers, and I don't care where they are. They're in politics or they're bloggers or whatever. They all are choking to death on their own well-packed colons. But this is what he said. This is what De Niro said. Callista Gingrich, Karen Santorum, Ann Romney. Now, do you really think our country's ready for a white first lady? The crowd roared and someone yelled, no! And De Niro said, too soon, right? Now, where does that come from? Well, all the racists back in the 2008 election, right? Remember the little subtexty thing? Is this country ready for a black first lady? Oh, no, black first Remember? Of course you do, you little buttercup. You remember that. Hell, if you're one of my right-wing listeners, you might have even passed that on, right? Wasn't that a knee slapper? Hey, is this country ready for a black first lady? Hell no! Remember that? Yeah, God damn it. So De Niro taking, playing off of that, is this country ready for a white first lady? Ooh! Well, guess what? The great defenders of racial justice and equality in this country, like, oh, let me find one here, Newt Gingrich! Newt Gingrich immediately jumped up out of the outhouse and demanded that Obama apologize for the comments De Niro made. Gingrich said in his constipated way, while he looks down there and over there and his animatronic wife stands next to him, beep, 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 boop, boop, beep, beep, boop, boop. Gingrich said, what De Niro said last night was inexcusable, and the president should apologize for him. It was at an Obama fundraiser. It is exactly wrong. You Pillsbury doughboy halfwit, what are you talking about? It's inexcusable, Newt. When's the last time someone told a joke that wasn't sexist or racist that you laughed at? You twit. And Gingrich is still in the race. Gingrich is still in the race. He and Callista continued to ride on, what's his name? What's the guy's name? The gambler, the money guy. Continues to ride on his money, flying here, flying there. Isn't that fun, Newt? Huh? Hot damn, boy. The White House today, yesterday, agreed with Gingrich. Michelle Obama's press secretary said, quote, we believe the joke was inappropriate. You have to do that sometimes to satisfy the caucasoids and their rage over the racial nature of the statement. Have you seen the bumper stickers out with the symbol that has come to represent Obama? And a sign, the slogan says, don't renege. Has Gingrich said anything about that? I don't think so. Gingrich said the comments made by De Niro divide the country. And Gingrich said, quote,
if people on the left want to talk about radio talk show hosts, then everybody in the country ought to hold the president accountable when somebody at his event says something as utterly, totally unacceptable as Robert De Niro said last night, end quote.
Then Gingrich added, on behalf of both my wife. Both your wives? Oh, on behalf of both my wife, on behalf of Karen Santorum, and on behalf of Ann Romney. Well, you don't say both and if you talk about three people, you halfwit. Oh, never mind. I think
De Niro is wrong. I think the country is ready for a new first lady, and he doesn't have to describe it in racial terms.
Is this goddamn hysterical? Every black person in America is looking at this going, oh, my God. These Caucasoids are nothing but an endless supply of mirth and merriment. This is incredible. Newt Gingrich coming to the defense of non-specific racial comment. Obama should apologize. I'll tell you what, Newt. If this were a two-way television, look over here. No, you see what I'm holding up? Here, apologize to this. Okay? Okay. See you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.